You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Today we are in Montilla.
Hello, buenas tardes from La Vuelta a España. My name is Daniel Freiber. I am the host of tonight's episode. And as you heard our friend Rob Hatch just say, I am in Montilla, home, I discovered today, of an extremely fine sweet wine. I'm actually leaning on a wine barrel. It looks like American oak, if you're listening, Brian Nygaard. And by sheer luck, by fortunate happenstance, the press room today is, because I'm standing outside it, it's also in a winery, the Bodega Alvear, founded in 1729, 2 years before Alejandro Valverde turned professional. Not quite. He hasn't quite been going for that long. Incidentally, I learned today, or I was reading something in preparation for today's episode, and I was reading about the 2006 Vuelta a España, and he said in 2006 he thought he had seven more Vueltas in him. And here we are in 2022. Joining me today from Villefranche-sur-Mer, where the Rolling Stones recorded Exile on Main Street in 1972, and where the Cycling Podcast will now record half of our Stage 13 episode of the Vuelta a España. He is the current AG2R Citroën professional and veteran of four Vueltas a España, also Tour de Suisse stage winner, 2017 US National Road Race champion. He's Motown's answer to Fausto Coppi, a rider so charismatic, even the microphones want his autograph. It's Lucky Larry Warbass. How are you, Larry?
Hey, Daniel. Yeah, doing well. Glad to be here again for another stage.
It's a good job this Vuelta's only 21 stages. Imagine how florid the introductions would become if it was any longer.
I like the introductions. They make me feel good about myself, you know?
How are you feeling about yourself, Larry? A few weeks into your comeback now. How's the training going?
Yeah, it's going pretty well. So, you know, I mean, I was back in the U.S., so now this week I've sort of been just trying to get over jet lag. I have a friend visiting, so, you know, trying to get some training in, but I'm not, you know, going overboard yet. So I have another scan next week to see if, like, I can come back to racing, hopefully soon. And then, yeah, I'm just trying to sort of get in as much training as I can without, like, killing myself. So,
are you still feeling okay about watching La Vuelta? Not experiencing too many pangs. We're in a beautiful part of Spain today.
I was going to say, I mean, it's not, I guess we'll talk about this more later, but I think even just seeing all the guys testing positive, I'm like, well, maybe if I was at the Vuelta, I wouldn't have lasted there that long anyway. So, you know, just trying to make myself feel not so bad while I'm watching it. But yeah.
Well, I mentioned it is a beautiful part of Spain. We're still in Andalucía. This morning I was in Ronda, Larry, home of a very famous bullring. You've been here in La Vuelta, in fact, home to a very famous bullfighting ring, the Plaza de Toros there. I was reading this morning, Larry, about a famous bullfighter in the 18th century there who did his best or worst, depending on whether you're an animal rights activist or not, best or worst work in the bullfighting ring in Ronda, in Pedro Romero, very famous, and he killed 6,000 bulls in his lifetime or in his career, the last of which were killed when he was over 80 years old in Madrid. So, well, maybe, who knows, maybe this is not Alejandro Valverde's last Vuelta a España. Maybe not. Larry, are you ready? Are you feeling primed and motivated for this evening's
El resumen del día a contrarreloj, the stage summary time trial.
And Larry, your super snood is on, you're ready to go, you're rolling down the ramp, and I am starting the stopwatch right now.
Okay, so today was stage 13 from Ronda to Montilla. It was 168.4 kilometers, and yeah, we ended up seeing a sprint finish. But most of the day, there was a three-rider breakaway. Three guys, Johan Bo, Ander Okamika, and Julius Vandenberg. They were 155 kilometers in the front. They got brought back by the peloton, who were, they were riding for Mads Pedersen. Cofidis was riding also. Luckily for Trek, Mads Pedersen won the stage ahead of Cocard and Pascal Ackermann. Ackermann did a nice attack in the finale, but Mads was just too strong, so he ended up having the perfect lead up by Ackermann to pretty handily take the win on the uphill sprint finish. Remco keeps his red jersey with his 2:41 gap over Primoz Roglic. Moss, Enric Moss, is still in third at 3:03. Mads Pedersen has an enormous lead in the green jersey. Then Jay Vine's in the KOM, Remco's in white, and UAE is still the best team. Oh, and then if we're going to talk about today also, Juan Ayuso was positive for COVID, but still in the race with a low viral load. So yeah, that's an interesting thing that I'm sure we'll talk more about.
That was a piece of news. That was a piece of news delivered with a very straight face, and we will talk about that actually in greater depth later on. But before we do that, in fact, let's just hear a little bit from Juan Ayuso's team manager, director sportif, Machin Fernandez, this morning. He talked about, well, what happens now with Juan Ayuso. Here is Machin.
No, it's the situation is the isolated rider, traveling only one car with the only one soigneurs, and isolated for the moment of the negative, but at that moment is the don't problem, it's a green light for a start, but it's isolated for the testing negative.
So Larry, that was Machin this morning of UAE saying that, well, now it's going to be a very lonely Vuelta for Juan Ayuso over the next few days because he's going to be in a car on his own. He's going to have his soigneur is going to be isolated, or that was sort of what Machin indicated. But there's a lot of controversy about this. There have been tweets today. We're going to touch on this. There are tweets from other riders today who are pretty unhappy that he's been able to carry on. There was a rider this morning, I won't name him, there was a rider in the mix zone this morning who could be clearly seen inching away from Juan Ayuso when Ayuso came into the mix zone. And it's become a bit of a hornet's nest, that whole topic. But as you mentioned, the stage win went as predicted, I suppose. He was the big favourite to Mads Pedersen of Trek Segafredo. He was expertly led out by his team, but they'd also done a good job of controlling the break that you mentioned. Let's hear now from Alex Kirsch, the Luxembourg rider who has been Mads Pedersen's lead out man throughout this Vuelta a España. His is the first voice you'll hear, and then from Johan Bol, who was in that break, that sort of suicide break you could call it, today for the Euskadi team, and he's also a former pro cycling Vuelta a España audio diarist. So let's hear from that pair now.
It's been coming for a couple of days. We tried a lot already and pulled a lot, so this is very satisfying. It's not so easy. We are with a group of climbers, so sprint-wise, we are a bit limited on what we can do, and we also lost one rider pretty early to a sickness, which was very important for us in the sprint. So actually today was just about, I tried to bring him in a good position for the last climb, and then he had the legs to do the rest.
He's made you guys work hard in this Vuelta a España, but how much of a, well, how satisfying has it been for you personally to do this job for Mads in such a successful race?
I think I was with him in every, except the Tour, I was in every race he won this year. So yeah, it's great to be part of it, and he really deserves this. Well, the team deserves it for the effort, but the motivation he brings to every race is just incredible, and so he definitely deserves this win also.
At the beginning we just went three in the break. I would prefer to go like 5-6. Like last year, I went in both with good riders, and we reached the finish line. But today, the people are reserving for tomorrow and for Sunday. But yes, we went well. We passed every time as we expected, and until 10 to the finish line, we got caught. But happy, no, because the team needs this time on TV, and also we have to reserve other people for tomorrow and Sunday stages. And yeah, the team is happy, and we will be strong to finish the Vuelta this year.
Here, you've had a lot of kilometres in the breakaway. Is that an objective for you personally, to have more kilometres than anyone else in the Vuelta?
Well, yeah. From now to the end, it would be a good achievement for me, no? A good prize. last year I went in three breaks, then I crashed in stage 17. I could not go in anymore. I just went in the gruppettos every day. But this year will be a nice prize, no? And also in the next days try and look for a new break and also look for a stage win.
Are you trying to get yourself noticed by a World Tour team to maybe move up a level?
Yeah, it would be good. Now I'm 25 this year. This is my third year in the team. I have one more year signed, but yeah, it would be great to be in a top level team. And yeah, I think I could do a nice job. But first, you have to achieve some goals and hear your name in every race. And that's why we are also always fighting for it.
Could it happen next year, maybe 2023?
It would be good. No, we will see. Next year, I have also one more year contract, but it would be nice to hear from other teams maybe along the year.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Vuelta a España, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, our title sponsors. Super Sapiens were founded by Phil Sutherland, a type 1 diabetic, and Phil also founded Team Type 1, which is now the Novo Nordisk team, and all of the riders on that team are type 1 diabetics, including Sam Brand from the Isle of Man. And we've been hearing from Sam over recent episodes, and here is Sam talking about some of the data he takes on board to ensure he gets his fueling strategy right.
Just trying to make sure that first and foremost, my diabetes management is the most important thing. Obviously, you need to fuel in a stage race. That's where it's probably the most critical. I have to obviously put more expenditure, obviously, in a breakaway day. I've taken out more energy, so I need to make sure I replenish that. And you can use the sensor to see where your sugars are at, where that's at. But also, you need to make sure that you need to cover what you've put out. So, you know, go to training peaks, check my expenditure, and then kind of eat based on that as well. So it's not all just sensor data, but it's a big part of it. So you see where you've been at, where you need to refuel, and you know, it's all using what you have available in terms of data to be able to make a decision that is best for you.
To find out more about Super Sapiens, go to supersapiens.com.
El Diario Roglic.
First of all, I'm sure you heard that Ayuso is tested positive, but he is staying in the race. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's part of it. I mean, we are living with it, with the COVID now in these times, and try to, stay healthy.
Safe racing next to him?
I have no option, huh? So yes, I have to do my job, I have to do the best I can.
So Larry, you know what I mean, huh? That was Primoz. That was the man himself. That was Primoz Roglic this morning speaking about, well, that issue we mentioned before the short commercial interlude. Juan Ayuso continuing in the Vuelta a España despite testing positive for COVID. His team are unusual, maybe unique in the Vuelta a España, in that they have the capacity, the ability, a machine, or I don't know how you do PCR tests, but they can do their own PCR tests. And this perhaps explains why they were able to establish that the viral load was small. That's what they've been saying. And this was approved also by the UCI and the race itself. Hence, Juan Ayuso staying in the race. However, I mentioned that not everyone is thrilled. A couple of riders who aren't at the race certainly are not thrilled. Jose Herrada of Cofidis has been tweeting. He's called it a circus that this is allowed to happen. Ángel Madrazo, who of course should have been riding the Vuelta a España for Burgos Biache, he said that what happened today was the kind of thing that took away your will to ride the bike, because I don't think he was experiencing symptoms either. And there have been a few. And Pavel Sivakov was another one a couple of days ago who had to pull out in the top 10, although he was asymptomatic. Haven't checked up on him or with him in the last day or so to see if he has developed any symptoms. But Larry, what do you make of it?
Yeah, you know, I think it's really it's a tough one to to say, because, I mean, yeah, maybe in all those other cases, they didn't check the viral load. And, you know, so, yeah, it's really hard to know. But I will say, I know that, like, UAE probably has one of the most, you know, I would say they have, like, a very high-level medical team. You know, like, I know Jeroen Swart, he's maybe the head doctor there. And, you know, I think he's pretty...
He's actually now head of performance. He's actually changed roles.
But anyway, I think they have, you know, quite a lot of experience. And, you know, I think it's a really reputable medical team there. And, I mean, I would guess that these doctors there wouldn't allow him to continue if it really was dangerous for the team or for his health. You know, like, I don't think they would risk their reputations like that. Because I do know that, like, yeah, it's a bit of a... I don't know, maybe a little bit of a battle sort of between, you know, maybe like the directors and managers of the team who want to have a great performance and then the doctors who are looking out for these riders' health. So I would imagine with, you know, the medical team that they have, they wouldn't risk their reputations and stuff if they really believe that it could be, you know, dangerous for their for his health or dangerous for other riders. So that's my two cents, but I can understand why the other riders are upset. You know, for example, at the Tour de Suisse, I tested positive the night before the last day. So, you know, we were going to do PCR tests the last day of the race. And the night before, I had had some symptoms. And so the director said, you know, that maybe it was a good idea that I, you know, do a test. And so, yeah, you know, it's probably couldn't hurt. So I did an antigen test and I was positive. And so they said, okay, you know, you can't start the next stage because it's dangerous for your health. And I was like, okay, well, it's a time trial. And like, you know, like fine if I can't start, but like, I think dangerous for my health, more dangerous for my health was racing with it in the 40 degree heat for 200 kilometers up these mountains the last days, you know, like, I don't think soft pedaling a time trial will be dangerous for my health in that regard. But, you know, cause I was like, oh, I could just isolate and whatever. Anyway, they weren't for it. And yeah, so I stopped the race. Luckily, no one else on the team was positive yet. I'm not sure, but I believe that might possibly be how Bob Jungels ended up, you know, having the same sort of circumstances as Ayuso at the Tour, because he was my roommate at Swiss. But you know, I think as we saw there, in the end, I think he was fine, Bob, at the Tour. So maybe we'll see a bit of the same thing with Ayuso. Clearly, it doesn't appear to have been affecting his performance. So maybe it really wasn't that bad. And maybe in the end, yeah, it won't affect his health and he may not be contagious for anyone else. But yeah, it's hard to say, you know, it's like we don't know that much about this still. And yeah, I can see why other guys are upset.
Yeah, I mean, I think the longitudinal scientific evidence, scientific studies, they're lacking.
Yeah.
Not least because, you know, COVID only originated in 2019, at the end of 2019, so there haven't been long-term studies. Also, you would like to think that the status of the rider and his position in a race and what is to gain for the team are not factors. However, in this case, the fact that he's riding high in the top five of the Vuelta a España, and also, you know, there was an analogous case with the same team in the Tour de France. Rafał Majka tested positive and carried on. The team chose to keep him in the race when Tadej Pogacar desperately, desperately needed his help. And I can see how that would sort of stick in the craw and upset some of the riders who have maybe, not that the team would have told them this explicitly, but they've maybe judged other riders to be more expendable in other circumstances. I'm not saying, Larry, that that's the case with you, because you're essential in every race that you do.
I mean, you're 100% right there, you know, I kind of left that part out, but that, like, yeah, I think it really does depend on who the rider is, and I guess more so their position in the race, because like it is important for the team. And so I guess that can definitely be a conflict of interest. But, you know, I think if the rider and the team are both on board and the medical team approves it, then you have to say it's okay. But yeah, that's a difficult one. And yeah, it's probably true. If Ayuso was in 87th place, he'd be out of the race. So yeah, what do you do there, you know? But maybe it's just because they'd say we wouldn't take any risk for that.
I mean, and this situation is even thornier at the moment because, well, there's a lot of talk of relegation from the World Tour, and there are teams that are in pretty dire straits on that score.
Yeah.
And there may be a temptation to keep riders in the race when perhaps they have tested positive for that reason, because they need to gain points. I mean, Theo Gegenhardt on Twitter a couple of days ago, he highlighted I think he made it pretty clear that he thought it was unfair to be holding, to have introduced this new system to coincide with the three seasons, don't forget it's three, it's 2020, 21, 22, which have all been badly affected by COVID. And those are the three seasons which dictate whether a team will survive or not in the World Tour. So I don't know. I mean, I thought it was good the other day when Luke Durbridge, he was very fair to the UCI, and he acknowledged, he said something that we don't say enough. That is, it's a difficult situation, and no one has a perfect solution. But I can also see how there will be multiple aggrieved parties, whichever decisions are taken.
It's funny though, because you know, I have a friend staying with me right now, and he's not a cyclist, but he's been following pretty closely, and he had, I thought, like quite an interesting opinion, because I said, you know, I don't know, I think it's a bit of a shame if, you know, we're always struggling for sponsors in cycling, and if we just kind of like lose, you know, a couple teams from the World Tour, or potentially, potentially if some teams don't get World Tour, they could lose their license, or, you know, I mean, they could lose their sponsors. And I said, you know, it would be a shame to lose these teams. And I was like, especially, you know, for example, a team like Movistar, who's been around for like 40 years. And he's like, you know, maybe for like long-term gain, there needs to be short-term casualties, you know? And like, yeah, maybe it's sad to lose a team like this or that or whatever. But in the end, like, maybe it shows that like teams need to modernize, they need to focus on, you know, certain things. And for example, Jumbo, you know, I don't know what, 5 years ago, they were probably one of the, or maybe a little, maybe, yeah, 5-6 years ago or something, they were probably one of the last teams in the ranking, you know? And then they had this sort of like, this moment where they realized like we better change something or else. And they just kind of like went back to the basics and then started, you know, built their whole current new philosophy, and now they're, you know, best in the world. So it might be difficult, but maybe it's what it's going to take for some teams to modernize, and maybe that pressure of potentially falling out every year could sort of just push the sport forward in the end.
Yeah, I think the sort of cautionary tales on that score may come from, well, for example, Italy, where they did lose all of their teams effectively, and the Italian cycling scene has been pretty much razed to the ground.
Yeah.
It's very difficult but that's also to do with the Italian economy. There aren't necessarily companies with the sort of disposable marketing budgets that there are in other countries. So it's a complex issue. But I can certainly see where your friend is coming from.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was interesting.
Movistar, some would argue that Movistar don't deserve to, you know, have another 10 or 20 years. I'm not necessarily of that view.
Me either.
Larry, a couple of other issues from today's, well, the finish, first of all, Mads Pedersen. Like to get your views on him, and also the fact that, well, we mentioned it with Brian Nygaard a few days ago, he's not going to the World Championships. He's so cited family reasons for this. He said it would be 7 weeks away from home if he went to Australia, so he'll be going back to Denmark after the Vuelta finishes in Madrid, skipping the Worlds. Mm. What do you make of that? And also just his season in general. He's had 3 second places at the Vuelta. I could have sworn, I've been here the whole time, and I could have sworn he'd won a stage before today.
You know, it's funny, today when I saw it, I was like, okay, it was good to see he won a stage, but I was like, I thought he actually had won one earlier, but I was like, I better check this before we speak.
I thought he'd won about three. Anyway, he hadn't. That was his first one. So he's had a great Vuelta. He won at the Tour. He won at Paris-Nice. He was eighth in Flanders, sixth in San Remo. So just talk to me a little bit about Mads Pedersen, his season, and that decision not to go to the Worlds.
I mean, I think he's had an amazing season because he's flown from start to finish. You know, I remember I was at Bessège. And I remember on this first day, this uphill finish, you know, he just crushed everyone. And on the second day, there was like a kilometer long uphill. And yeah, he finished second there. So that was like super impressive. And that race, yeah, he really, really impressed me. And then, yeah, he won Paris-Nice. He won two stages at Circuit de la Sarthe. He won a 1.2 in Denmark. He won a stage at Belgium Tour, you know, won a stage of the Tour de France. So just the whole year, he's been super consistent and awesome. So, you know, I think he's had an awesome season. And I actually think it's a bit of a shame that he's not going to the Worlds because I think he'd be a really big favorite to win. But from what I heard, I rode with one of his teammates yesterday. And he said he looked at the course and he saw it's 4,000 meters of climbing and just said, okay, well, then it's not for me. Even though maybe like the circuit, the way it is, you know, with such a long race, 4,000 meters seems like a lot on paper, but if you break it down, it might not actually be that crazy. But yeah, that's what I heard was just, he thought, okay, it's just 4,000 meters is too much for me.
It's something we talk about pretty much every year on the podcast, how even professional riders, professional coaches, national team coaches find it very difficult to read a world championship circuit. Partly because, well, they don't have the heritage of previous races having taken place on the same circuit. Circuit races themselves are kind of a law unto themselves and difficult to read. And maybe it has something to do as well with the sort of amalgamation of riders from different teams, different trade teams. That also makes it difficult. We've even heard riders in the week before the Worlds get it completely wrong before they've gone to, you know, whether it be Australia or Qatar or somewhere else. And they've said, look, it's going to finish in a sprint or it's going to finish in a small group, and have been proven completely wrong.
It's tough. I mean, I don't know, but it looks like it's going to be a small group.
Larry, just one other thing I wanted to ask you about in relation to today's stage. Yoann Bal, we mentioned him, the Euskaltel rider who was in the break today. He's been in a few breaks in this Vuelta a España. And I sort of pressed him, as we heard earlier, about whether he was trying to impress at this Vuelta, whether he had designs on a contract in the World Tour. I just wanted to ask you, how good a reference is repeatedly getting into breaks in a race like the Vuelta a España? It strikes me that it's not something necessarily that World Tour team managers are that interested in or impressed by.
So I think that really depends on the breakaway. So, you know, for example, on a day, I'm trying to think of one of the days we saw a really strong break in the Vuelta, but you know, if there's like, there are certain days that it's very hard to get in and there's a big battle and you know, sometimes you still see the same guys up there. So if he gets in as many breaks as Wout van Aert did in the Tour de France, then yeah, for sure. But if it's like, you know, like it's hard to say, and I don't mean to sound like offensive by saying this, but in a token break like today, kind of, you know, like a day like today, you know, looks like there's just no fight and they let three guys go. Getting in a break like that, it's not hard to do. And I don't think that really, you know, it's great for a sponsor like Euskaltel. You're getting like a lot of time on TV, you're out front, but it's not something that a lot of World Tour teams are going to look at and say, wow, like, you know, that guy's really good. But for example, I think a guy who did a really good job over the last years, and I would say it was his sort of breakaway prowess that got him a contract in the World Tour was my former teammate Simon Pelot, who was at IAM with me and now he's at Trek. And, you know, he rode for Androni for the last couple of years and he just really made breakaways his thing. And, you know, he started out by going sort of in these like token breakaways that weren't that special. But like, as he started to do that, he kind of got a knack for it. And then he started to get in better and better breakaways. And then, you know, he started to come close to the win a couple times, or at least close to some good results, or getting some good results as a result of these breakaways. And, you know, I'm pretty sure that is what got him his World Tour contract. So it's definitely a possibility, but it depends on the break and it depends, you know, how it goes. And it depends if you're getting results or not. So I think those results at the end are really what counts.
And Larry, just a very final thing on the sprint finish. Brian Cockart was second. Now, this story was reported earlier today that he intends to leave the race tonight to go to race, I think, in France. He's going to race again to try and pick up World Tour points and to help his team's efforts to stave off relegation. He'll need approval from the UCI to do this. I don't think he'll get it, although I didn't think he would get it. And then a colleague of mine pointed out to me that Cofidis is a sponsor of the Vuelta a España. Yeah. And I don't know if that's going to have anything to do with it. But
yeah, because it's actually I think it's the director of the race that you're at, not the UCI. So you have to get approval from like the director of the Vuelta, like a permission, I'm pretty sure.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So he's probably got a pretty good chance.
Yeah, I guess so. And also, I mean, maybe, you know, it's probably something that they would have discussed with him before the race. I don't think they just go to the race and then hope that the guy would say yes. You know, I'm pretty sure before they went to the race, they'd ask him, you know. So yeah, I think I'm sure he has a great chance.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel here to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Noom. And if you've been listening to the Cycling Podcast over the past year, you'll know that I've been using Noom since last September. First of all, I wanted to lose some weight because I was not happy with the weight that I crept up to, but I didn't like the idea of going on a conventional diet and being restricted in the types of food that I ate. I actually wanted to change my eating habits for the better and in a more sustainable long-term way. And Noom's messaging right from the start was about just embedding some healthy, sustainable eating habits. No food is totally off limits, so I could have an occasional steak or glass of wine or beer when I fancied without knocking the diet for six and feeling that I'd failed, because it takes a much more holistic view of each day, each week, each month to just gradually nudge your eating habits into a good direction. And that's how I found it worked for me, and particularly once I started to lose weight, I started to feel better on and off the bike. And that encouraged me to keep going. And it also opened my eyes to how many calories are in certain types of food that I was eating that I perhaps didn't really want or need. So I feel like all of the benefits for me have been positive. Now, if you'd like to give Noom a try, sign up for your trial at noom.com/cycle. That's noom.com/cycle. Lose the weight for good with Noom. But if you are thinking about losing a considerable amount of weight or you have any other kind of health considerations, do seek advice from a medical professional before embarking on any kind of diet.
El ritmo de la vuelta. The rhythm of the vuelta.
This is El Ritmo de la Vuelta, our Rioja adult moonwalk into the sonic archives of this race through the official anthems that have by turns made heads bop and ears explode since the tradition was introduced in 1978. Today, Larry, we're going back to 2006 when the official song was called En qué estrella estar, in which star will it be or will he be? It was performed by a band called Nene da Conte, fronted by the Madrid-born vocalist Mai Meneses. The single featured on the band's first album, He Perdido los Zapatos, I Lost My Shoes, which was released 5 years after Meneses' breakthrough on the TV talent show Operación Triunfo. Now, I've chosen 2006 partly because yesterday we discussed the Vuelta that took place a few weeks after the Festina scandal. Today, I thought we'd look at the one that went ahead in the immediate aftermath of Operación Puerto. not a talent show. Of course, that doping investigation had cost the Tour de France three of its favourites for victory in Jan Ullrich, Alexander Vinokourov and Ivan Basso. And now a similar threat hung over the Vuelta. Alejandro Valverde had started the Tour, though didn't finish. And he was also now being widely linked to Eufemiano Fuentes, the doctor at the centre of the scandal. At the same time, officials from both the Vuelta organiser Unipublic and the Spanish Cycling Federation declared Valverde clean beyond any doubt. Statements with which the UCI and WADA would ultimately disagree, although it would take them years to prove it. Vinokourov, meanwhile, had to wait until the last minute, just hours before the Vuelta start, for the UCI to ratify the new name, Astana, and license of his Puerto Ravage team. The race began in Malaga on August 26th, and you guessed it, turned into a battle between Valverde and Vinokourov. The former took the gold jersey on stage 9 to La Cobertoria and would keep it throughout the second week. Then, though, Vinokourov and his teammate and compatriot Andrei Kasheshkin detonated the race on the stage to the Sierra de la Pandera, which this year's peloton has a date tomorrow. Kasheshkin took the stage, Vinokourov the jersey. Vinokourov would then solidify his advantage by winning the penultimate day TT. He was the 33rd foreign winner of the Vuelta. But by the end of the decade, Vinokourov, Valverde and Kasheshkin would all also have been sanctioned for doping. So that was 2006, Larry. Traditionally, I ask you, after every one of these, did you see it? No, you didn't, because you weren't following the Vuelta in 2006, were you?
No, not very closely.
Any dealings with Vino down there on the Riviera?
No, I've passed him a couple times. I actually see his sons a lot. So, you know, both his sons are like elite under-23 riders. And we used to, like, there was this one guy who motor paced. Unfortunately, he passed away, but he motor paced most of the pros down here. And he also motor paced Vino's son. So sometimes, like, they'd motor pace before me. And so then I'd meet them. And I don't usually see Vino with them. It's just these two guys train together. And then I pass them a lot. They seem to train pretty hard. So,
Larry, talking of welters of yore, 2017, the race should have gone, well, it did go to La Pandera. Unfortunately, you did not. You pulled out on stage 7.
Yeah, I crashed and broke both my hands, so it would have been difficult to make it up.
Yes,
yeah.
It would have been tough. Larry, we're going to move swiftly on to, well, the main subject of our third part this evening, and, well, it's about a rider who fascinates, intrigues a lot of fans. His name is Mark Padun, Ukrainian rider riding for EF Education First, Easy Post. Soared to prominence really in 2021 with a double stage win at the Dauphiné, and then he seemed to fall out with his team Bahrain last year and was picked up by EF, signed by Jonathan Vauters, who said that his performances had messed up the head of sports science mathematical model. So prodigious were they. He started well this year for EF Education First. He won TT in the Gran Camino and was third overall. That was a race in Spain earlier in the year. But then, 2 weeks later, he had a DNF at the Tirreno, and then shortly after that, DNF'd as well at the Tour of the Basque Country. And yes, he is a bit of an enigma, shall we say. His performances are very, very up and down. There have been all sorts of theories that have been put forward for this. Jonathan Vauters himself has talked about his difficulty with weight control and eating. Padun himself has talked about this, I think. Being a Ukrainian, he's also had personal issues to deal with over the last few years. He hails from the region, the Donbass region, which was the epicenter of the first outbreak of the Ukrainian war in 2014. His parents no longer live in Ukraine, but he still has friends and family there. And, well, he was nowhere to be seen at the Tour de France, didn't ride the Tour de France, wasn't selected, but he is here at the Vuelta, was in a 166-kilometre breakaway on the stage to Pico Jano, but generally has been looking, sniffing around for breakaways and for a stage victory, but he hasn't achieved that yet. This morning in Ronda, I spoke to Mark Padun, and he is the subject of today's Encuentro del Día.
El Encuentro del Día, the meeting of the day.
Well, Mark, how's your Vuelta so far?
Oh, so far it's good. I've been in a breakaway once. I saw that in uphill finishes I still not really far from the best guys, so I quite satisfied with where I am.
I think it was, well, it was a bit of a difficult summer for you. Just give me your summary of May, June, July.
Oh, it was not only summer, but also the spring as well, as I got sick on Tirreno Adriatica. I didn't come back already till Dauphiné properly to the races. And even on Dauphiné, I was really in my bad maybe in a worse shape. I participated in the races. As 4 weeks of altitude in May didn't went really bad for me. I overtrained myself. So should to take some break again after the Dauphiné, and then from July start like from zero. So yeah, it was quite a difficult year so far.
Everyone says about you, Mark, that you go up and down a little bit. Yeah. more than other guys. What's your explanation for that?
Yeah, I'm doing that and still working on that, because I'm the guy who's doing too much. And now we just went on control of everything, of my food, because I actually treat everything as scales, because I'm the one guy who, if I don't want to eat, I will not eat a little bit, I will not eat at all. Or if I'm hungry, I'm gonna like overeat instead of doing what I should do. The same is with the training and with altitude. So, and every year it's still repeating. It was the same also this year, and this arrived the moment when I said actually to myself, like, enough, it's enough. I should follow the baseline and in any cost. And now, as you see, it's going well through the world and through Tour of Poland.
And you're working with a nutritionist on the team, aren't you?
Yeah.
Has that helped? I know you were at Bahrain as well, but I think you're working with a new nutritionist on this team. Is it helping?
Yeah, it still happened to me a lot. We're doing like we're tracking everything every day. It's still really, really difficult work to do, but I saw the results and it's still really motivating me. Like, yeah, it's not any enjoyable anymore. Like to sit on the table and have a food, it's like a work for me. But as long as I'm enjoying my bike, I'm gonna continue to do it.
And when you're stressed, for example, when you've got other things going on, and then does that make it harder to control your diet?
Yeah, it's make harder, but as like once, twice, three times when you surpass this, it's make it easier, and mentally it's easier to surpass the desire to have some food. Obviously, I'm a human. It's not like for the last 2 months I've been following like 100% diet. I have 2 or 3 days when I went out a little bit, but 2 or 3 days in the terms of 2 months, it's basically nothing. So I'm not judging myself anymore, and the difference compared to the last years is that after that day, I'm not punishing myself. I just coming straight away back to my normal routine, and the weight and feelings are coming back to normal.
And another thing people say about you, Mark, is that, or in the last few months, is you've got a lot going on in your life. I think they're referring also to what's happening in Ukraine. I mean, how much is that affecting you, or has it affected you this year? And what about it is affecting you?
Yeah, I couldn't say that this didn't affect me at all. And also, I cannot say that this affects me like a lot. It's always been there. Luckily, my parents are not living anymore in Ukraine. And it's really helped, because when the war has started in 2014, they were there. They were in Donetsk, where I'm born and raised. And to be honest, like, imagine myself to be in this kind of situation for the second time, it will be a hell. And the same is going for my parents. So thankfully to God that they are not in Ukraine. They were not in Ukraine on the start of the like global war with the Russia Ukraine, not only on my local area. And yeah, it's making the situation much easier. But anyway, like knowing that it's going war, like real proper war already for the half of year in your own country where you have relatives, where you have friends. It's not the thing that's just somewhere there, just still here, and every day, so just reading the news and worrying a little bit.
When I spoke to Yaroslav Popovich at the Giro, he said that, well, the Western world or Western Europe, they were interested for 3 or 4 weeks, and it was on the news in every country, and everyone was very sympathetic, and then people kind of moved on and got bored, and Ukraine kind of got forgotten about a little bit. Do you have that impression as well?
Yeah, it's nothing new, actually. It's happened completely the same in 2014, and it's happening now, like the same story, like, because everybody expected that they're gonna do this kind of restrictions, political restrictions, whatever, and in 2-3 weeks it's gonna be finished. But already more than half of year has passed, and something should be done. More, I don't know what should be done. I'm not a politician, I'm not military, but obviously we can see that people are boring what they're doing. Everybody's still suffering because of the high prices here in Europe, and
I'll let you go, but just tell me, what's your dream for the rest of the Vuelta?
I'm looking forward to be in a breakaway again, in a breakaways again, and I really want to be in a stage here, as I believe it's possible.
Okay, Larry, well, a lot to get our teeth into there, particularly, I think, with regard to an issue that's, well, a sort of universal head scratcher for professional cyclists, the issue of weight and diet. I mean, there are some quite striking comments there from Mark Pudden, talking about it not being enjoyable to sit at a table and eat food anymore, because he's really trying to control his eating this year, working with this new nutritionist at EF Education First, surpassing the desire to have food, and he's learning not to judge himself, not punishing himself. How much of that rings true for you and would ring true for other pro cyclists?
Oh, definitely. Definitely rings true for me. And I think probably every one of us, you know, it's something I say kind of often when people ask, is that, you know, I don't know. I think some cyclists have eating disorders, but I think every one of us has disordered eating. You know, it's like,
yeah, I was about to say, I mean, I'm glad you made that point, Larry, because as soon as you say eating disorder, it gets sort of classed, catalogued as a pathology,
exactly,
as an illness. But really, all you're saying is that the eating is disordered, i.e. it doesn't really follow the patterns that most people would consider to be conventional.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I think if you probably looked at the definition of eating disorder, we probably all have eating disorders, but yeah, you know, I would say like disordered eating is maybe a little more like accurate. It's just that, you know, I don't think any of us go a day without thinking about food, you know, or, you know, a day, you know, we don't even go an hour without thinking about food. You know, I wake up and, you know, I go to bed planning my breakfast. I plan what I'm going to eat on the bike. And as I'm riding, I plan what I'm going to eat for lunch. You know, I'm thinking about, you know, what snacks I'm going to have and what I'm going to do for dinner. So, you know, I just think also for me, one of the things I've said, you know, I think the hardest thing for me is just the diet and the weight, you know, because I love food and, you know, I really enjoy eating. And it's also just something that I was raised with. My whole family's super into food. You know, they're kind of foodies and my mom's an amazing cook. So yeah, it's like, it's a really tough thing because, you know, I think there are some riders who are totally cool with just being like, you know, food is fuel. For me, food is fuel, but like, it's also, you know, pleasure, one of my greatest pleasures in life, right? So, and I know there's a lot of riders who are like me. There's a lot of riders who are really into food and, you know, it's hard. And it's interesting. I noticed actually a big difference between some of the, you know, European riders like the French and the Anglos. Like for some reason, I feel like Anglo riders are all of this sort of sort where like, it's really hard for us to like push, but we can push really hard. And, you know, maybe we push too hard sometimes, but then we kind of go the other way.
With restriction,
you know, because then when you restrict, then you have to like go the other way, right? And then, you know, you binge. And so it's funny because I feel like it's something that with a lot of the Anglo guys, you know, I can kind of relate to in the off season, you know, we put on probably a few too many kilos. Whereas like, you know, I know a lot of my French teammates, like they could never put that much weight on because they'd think it was never possible to lose it again. So, you know, this thing about yo-yoing everything, it's hard. And, you know, I think it's an affliction that 90% of riders probably suffer. So yeah, you know, I've definitely also, you know, I've heard, I mean, I think Mark Padun, it's probably even more challenging for him than for some others. You know, I heard he did this thing called like the the carnivore diet, or, you know, he did like this only protein diet last year, and that was how he lost all this weight. And then, you know, he was flying in the Dauphiné. But, you know, I think the thing is, when you do these crazy restrictive crash diets, like, maybe they do work for a period of time, but they're not sustainable. And, you know, so I think that's probably why, like, you know, if you lose weight so fast, you probably won't lose the power that you had immediately. Or at least you won't lose the power as fast as you lost the weight. But eventually it'll come back to bite you. And so I think that's probably what happened last year in the Dauphiné. He lost all this weight, and it was just this perfect moment where, you know, he was flying because he lost the weight. He still had the power, but then, you know, it kind of maybe came back to bite him in the ass a bit later. So, you know, I think the best riders we see, they're able to find that equilibrium with diet. And, you know, I think that can also be aided by nutritionists. And that's probably what, you know, Mark Padun is sort of chasing now, but it's really not an easy thing to balance or manage. So yeah, but that's definitely ideal if you can be sort of balanced and slow in your, you know, weight loss and, yeah, I guess balanced with your diet. That's the best, but it's not easy to do, that's for sure.
I mean, two things that really, really resonate with me. One thing that he said about, well, repeating the same mistake year after year after year, and you know, this perhaps is difficult for people to understand, but it rings true for me, or it resonates for me, because, you know, in the last few years I've been writing a book about Jan Ulrich, who famously had this problem. He could never find a solution to this problem, and people were just exasperated because it was so obvious what he needed to change, the mistake that he needed to correct, yet he couldn't do it. And then what you said there, Larry, about, you know, just finding a sweet spot and finding a perfect storm, or also just purging yourself over a short period of time, as Ulrich did every year, you know, you can get yourself into good condition, but it's probably not sustainable. I mean, how do you personally find your sweet spot? Do you weigh your food, and have you had periods when you've got into difficulties?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've definitely struggled to get to my race weight a lot. And, you know, some years I've just never even gotten to what I think is probably my ideal race weight. And I would say for a period of time, yeah, I tracked all the food I ate. You know, I measured everything. I weighed everything. I counted every calorie, you know, in and out.
How much fun was that?
I mean, to be honest, at first it sucks. But then you get in this kind of habit and routine where it's not that bad. Because the one thing that it allows me to do, at least, and I think with a lot of people, is it allows you to realize, like, actually, I can, like, budget in an ice cream, you know? So, like, you know, I would get really lean, but I would eat a giant bowl of ice cream every single day because I would count, you know, like, okay, like, I'm going to have a little less pasta, but then a ton of ice cream. And yeah, so in the end, it's interesting because when you do this, you realize that, like, a lot of us, we probably aren't eating enough on the really big days where we're training really hard or riding really long. And then we're eating too much on like some of the shorter days. And so it's at least interesting to learn these things. But this year I got away from that and I just tried to fuel really well on the bike, you know, eat a ton on the bike. That's something that, you know, has been a big movement in cycling now. We're all eating, you know, a lot. Like, you know, we can eat anywhere from 300 to 500 calories an hour in a race or hard training, which is just so different than it used to be. And then, I try to be really conscious about consuming a lot of carbs in and around my training. And then, yeah, smart on the days where I'm going easier. So it seemed to work pretty well for me. And I've gotten to really good, like, lean body composition while also, like, maintaining my hormones and stuff. Because, you know, we have to do quarterly blood tests for the UCI, everything. So you see kind of like how it affects your hormones and your blood values. And a lot of times when I've tried to do this, you know, measuring, counting, everything, it's like everything just drops off, you know, like, you know.
Your hemoglobin.
Supplement. To be honest, more it's like testosterone and stuff. So, you know, I've talked with a lot of riders and I think like all of us have had nearly zero testosterone at a point because like, we just got too skinny or lost weight way too rapidly and things like that. And like, you know, that's probably one of the first things to go. And so I don't think that's good for your health, and it's not good for your performance. So it's just, you know, it's tough. And if you do it the right way, then like what I've found also is like, if I've lost weight slowly or done it more controlled, then yeah, actually those things don't drop, you know, like you can still have like normal testosterone and be a lean, you know, high performing cyclist. So it's kind of interesting. But yeah, I think it's something that a lot of people don't really realize, that like, you know, these crazy crash diets where you push so hard can really wreak havoc on your body.
Yeah, and it's also a difficult topic as well, because there is a duty of care on the part of the teams, and they need to be empathetic and they need to be sympathetic, but there is also no getting around the fact that power to weight ratio is a thing. And
yeah.
A more advantageous power to weight ratio will improve your performances.
I would say empathy on the part of the teams in terms of weight is not so common. yeah, to put it you know, lightly, you know, especially like, for example, in French teams, I think weight is probably one of the most important things. And, you know, that's something I learned when I came here. And I think it's just kind of in the culture of French cycling is that like, you need to be skinny, 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 and then you need to be strong. So, you know,
ironic in a country when you can't go for a meal without them serving a kilo of cheese or
butter
innards or
I know,
on every dish,
exactly. Yeah. But yeah, somehow they can avoid it, but yeah.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the cycling podcast. I'm just about to place an order on scienceinsport.com using the discount code SISCP25 to get 25% off. I have noticed with great excitement that the Tiramisu Go Energy Bakes are back in stock. They weren't there last week when I checked, but they are back in stock now. So I'm going to press checkout on my basket before anyone else gets in there to make sure that I've got some of the Tiramisu Energy Bakes for our Tour de Corse, the second half of which we will be riding towards the end of this month.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
So, Larry, la cena de ayer. I mean, I'm getting bored of discussing all of these meat dishes that I have had. But actually, there is one I'm quite looking forward to this evening, because we're staying in Córdoba. And last year, I was introduced to something called flamenquin, which is a kind of baton, a sort of cordon bleu, I think it's pork in breadcrumbs, but with jamon serrano wrapped around the pork under the breadcrumbs. It might even have cheese in the middle, but it's a curious...
Fitting after we talk about weight, yeah.
Yeah, a curious gastronomic phenomenon. And maybe in just a second we'll have a guest who can, well, enlighten us a little bit more on flamenquin. But Larry, let's get to tomorrow's stage. And what can you tell us? What's coming?
Okay, so tomorrow is stage 14 from Montoro to Sierra de la Pandera. It's 160.3 kilometers with 3,341 meters of climbing. It's a mountaintop finish at 1,815 meters. And yeah, it's a pretty easy, flat-ish first half of the stage and a hard last 60 kilometers with a couple climbs before the final. Final's pretty long. And I don't know, I guess for me, my prediction is we will see a breakaway take the win. But I don't think it's going to be the usual suspects climbers in the breakaway. Like, I don't know if we'll see a guy like Jay Vine there tomorrow unless it's a really big breakaway. Just because, yeah, when it's totally flat like that at the start, it's a lot harder to get in for, like, the pure climbers and stuff. So I think it'll be an interesting mixed group, and we'll see sort of a, you know, an all-around sort of rider taking the win at the end of the day. Because, yeah, it's a 21K climb at the end. Should be hard in the finish.
Well, Larry, tremendous job. However, we're going to turn to a couple of Andalusians to help us find out a little bit more about this climb, La Pandera.
Sounds good.
It debuted in the world in 2002. It was apparently discovered because a local lady sent a letter to the previous, not the current, race director, Victor Cordero. And it was kind of dubbed as the Angliru of the South. Hasn't really lived up to that billing. The world has been there a few times. Heras won there, Valverde, Kashechkin, Cunego and Micah the last time. But talk about those two Andalusians. The first one we'll hear from is our old mate Luis Angel Mate. Of course, we know he is planting trees for every kilometre he's in the breakaway here at the Vuelta. Not going too well at the moment. 24 kilometres, I think he's done so far. However, I spoke to him at the finish today, and, well, I also asked him about La Pandera. So here is Luis.
Well, Luis, another day on home roads. Unfortunately, still no break for you. How tough is it out there to get into the right move?
Not break, not trees. No, the last 3-4 days I feel chic, and yeah, I prefer don't try to take the breakaway when I don't feel good. Today I feel good, the first day after 1 week, and still two hard days in Andalusia, and tomorrow we try.
Just tell us quickly about La Pandera.
Yeah. La Pandera is a really hard climb, because also you start to climb before the climb. The road is nasty with a lot of steep repechos, when say in Spanish.
Steep ramps.
Steep ramps, yeah. And the last part, the barrier to the top, is a really, really, really hard climb. I think it's also for the weather, the temperature so high, and will be really hard.
Thanks, Luis. Let's get some trees tomorrow.
Thank you.
Well, good to hear Luis Angel Mate. I couldn't work out there whether he said he'd been feeling chic, sick, or something else. Could have been something else. I said Luis, well, obviously he's from Andalusia. He's the lynx of Marbella. Now we're going to turn to a familiar voice on the podcast. In fact, I'm going to sort of introduce ad hoc. This is not an official feature yet. We haven't got a jingle for it. But I'm going to introduce a new feature. It's Gazing Wistfully with Fran Reyes. Because Fran Reyes, and we had him back a couple of days ago, and he gazed wistfully out over the Mediterranean. He offered us a fantastic description of where we were. Fran's back with us tonight. He's from Almeria, which is in Andalusia. Fran, gaze wistfully for us. Tell us where we are. Survey, paint a picture for us.
Hello, Daniel. Hello, Larry. Nice to meet you. And hello, listeners. Great to be talking to you again. Have you noticed that we are going from one village in festival to the next?
Yes, and fiestas in Andalusia are a big thing, aren't they?
Yeah. So pretty much every village in Andalusia, and well, in the whole Spain, but especially in Andalusia, every village has its week during the summer on which they have the feria, which is the summer festival. So to describe you, well, both Ronda and Montilla are in feria this week. To describe you guys how a feria feels like for a small Andalusian child like myself, I'm going to ask you something. Picture yourselves 8 years old.
This is it. We like this. Come on, Fran. This is exactly what I wanted. Come on.
Picture yourselves 8 years old, surrounded by 1,000, 2,000 people that you know from finding them in the streets. It's night, yet there is light on every corner because they have installed light. So it feels like day. And all around yourself, there is this environment of party. There is this environment with music filled with the different odors of all these food trucks that, you know.
Don't mention food. We've just been discussing how Larry has to restrict his diet as a professional cyclist. You might send him over the edge.
But you know, for nowadays, burgers are something quite common. But back in the day, the first time I saw a burger, it was during the feria. Because there was some food truck coming with burgers.
Fran, you're about 22.
Yeah.
How can this
no,
be?
No, 22, no. I'm 31. Okay. I'm 31. I'm getting older, man. I'm growing older. And also, at night, during the feria, you can have churros. And you find your grandmother. And you find your cousins. And you run around at 2 a.m. That's beautiful. And if also there is a cycling race coming. Do you know how beautiful that is? In the Basque Country, every village has a cycling race for whatever category during the fiestas.
I can't work out whether this is a feature that should be repeated or whether it's like a bad ayahuasca trip. Fran, thank you very much for that. Well, that was a window into the Andalusian world and culture. And, well, it could only have come from you, couldn't it? Fran, tomorrow who's going to win the stage?
Well, it's
More importantly, is Remco going to be put on the ropes tomorrow? I'm going to ask you this as well, Larry.
I think Remco will be put on the ropes on Sunday, because yesterday Enric Mas at the end of the stage, he said that Peñas Blancas was about wearing people out as much as possible, and tomorrow Sierra La Pandera, we can deem it as a similar kind of climb, and it will be also about wearing people down. They will try to put domestics on the breakaway in order to pull at certain kilometers, but the real goal is to try and really put Remco in difficulty on the stage of Sierra Nevada, where there is more altitude to be climbed.
Your thoughts, Larry?
I kind of agree. I don't think like tomorrow is hard enough to put Remco on the ropes. I think it's way like to his style of climb, and it's going to be fast. And I mean, there's only like, there's 1 kilometer that's super hard, but I don't see him faltering yet. I don't even know if I see him faltering this week, potentially just the last week. But yeah, the day after tomorrow is like a super hard climb. So
Have you been up there on training camps? I think
this year we were there. I've been there quite a few times. And they go from, I'm pretty sure they do Hazayanas at the bottom, which is like really steep, super hard. And that's just like the first 30 minutes of the climb. So the first 30 minutes of the climb are totally brutal, and you have like an hour of climbing after. So, terrible.
Well, chaps, that is something that we will definitely look forward to. That just about concludes this evening's entertainment. I should also mention that Ian Boswell should have been among our guests this week, but we must offer our condolences to Ian, because his friend, the Kenyan cyclist Sula Kangangi, was killed in a crash at the Vermont Overland Gravel Race last weekend. So Ian has not been able to join us, understandably, this week, but he may be back next week. Fran, I'm going to thank you for your inimitable contribution to the podcast again. And Larry, I do believe that you will be joining me tomorrow.
I'll be
on La Pandera, the Angler of the South, but we'll be speaking to the listeners again around about this time tomorrow. So thanks, Larry, and hasta luego.
Ciao.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.